You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by producer Samantha. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about ACT local candidates opposing moves to mitigate the climate crisis at a local level, the ban of Israeli MPs Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich for visiting the country, and changes to proposed anti-stalking laws. I also spoke to Claudia Rosas, a lecturer in critical studies at the University of Auckland, about the new English curriculum, the new proposed English curriculum, and the need for Māori and Pacific authors to be engaged with. Samantha, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to PSA organizer Claire Nixon about staffing and funding cuts at the National Geohazard Monitoring Center and its implications for the public. I also spoke to Dr. Justin Sobian, Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, about the Princess of Tonga calling for Wales to be granted legal personhood.
Hei aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text it on 5395, or wai mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei, kōrero ano hei pakihiri roki roki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The ACT Party has recently announced that candidates standing in local elections, if elected, will oppose attempts to mitigate emissions at a local level. ACT local government spokesperson Cameron Luxton says councils should focus on what they can control and not costly symbolic declarations. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about this move. We also discussed the government's sanctions on Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. New Zealand has joined countries such as the UK, Australia, Canada and Norway in banning these Israeli MPs over allegedly inciting extremist violence against Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and undermining peace for a two-state solution. Finally, we discussed changes being made to the proposed anti-stalking laws. But first, we discussed ACT candidates opposing attempts to mitigate emissions at a local level. Why will ACT local candidates oppose these measures at a local level?
Simply because climate activism from local councils is a waste of money, and that's why ACT councillors will put a stop to it. There's no point in local councils coming up with declarations of a climate emergency. Declaring something an emergency doesn't fix it. We don't want councils to be sending staff on ratepayer-funded climate junkets. Wellington Council just spent around $200,000 on international travel for staff and councillors over the past couple of years, travelling to conferences. And when we think about how do we reduce emissions in New Zealand, they're already covered by the emissions trading scheme, which puts a price at the moment of somewhere between $55 and $60 a tonne on all emissions. So councils that want to reduce emissions can simply choose to drive less, buy EVs for their operations. And, you know, that's the kind of action that all New Zealanders are thinking about when they go and put petrol in the car. You know, I'm paying $9, $10, $11 every time I fill up. So, you know, it behoves the individual to make those decisions about how to reduce emissions. The price incentive is there.
If we are looking at Auckland City Council specifically here, in 2023 we saw the Auckland anniversary floods and Cyclone Gabriel batter parts of the city. Despite opposing attempts to manage emissions at a local level, are there plans for these ACT local candidates to support local communities that may inevitably be impacted by the climate crisis in any way?
Well, absolutely. We do not think that councils should be trying to change the weather with emissions control strategies that are already covered by central government policies and actions, but certainly planning for resilience, making sure that councils invest in things like, you know, stormwater management, stop banks, and actually just getting the council maintenance contractors out there to clear drains, you know, suck out the catch pits before we have a storm, and make sure that channels and urban streams are not blocked by vegetation or people having built fences in the way. I mean, a lot of those things did contribute to the flooding that we saw around anniversary weekend in Auckland 2023. And ACT councillors will be focusing on those practical measures to reduce the impacts of climate change and weather events on our cities.
On to our next topic. New Zealand has joined the likes of the UK, Australia, Canada and Norway in banning Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich of allegedly inciting extremist violence against Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and undermining peace for a two-state solution. What are the ACT Party's thoughts on this move?
Well, as a member of the government, I stand behind the positions taken by Winston Peters as our foreign minister, but I do want to note that those bans are targeted at those specific individuals for their specific statements that they've made. This is not a sanction on the actions that Israel has taken or on Israel's policies or on Israel's right to defend itself. This government continues to support the Israeli people who've suffered immeasurably after the Hamas attacks of October 7, 2023, and who continue to suffer through Hamas's ongoing refusal to release their hostages, and of course now with Iran's retaliation against Israel's strikes on their nuclear facilities.
This is not the first time the country has imposed sanctions on Israelis. Last year, we imposed a ban on 33 Israeli settlers the country deemed as violent extremists. Could we see further sanctions on Israel and specifically Israeli MPs?
Well, my expectation is that when individuals are identified as, you know, having contributed to the kind of things that these that the people who have been banned, their actions that have been ascribed to them, then, you know, I would think that New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade will be making those recommendations. But I don't see anything further coming up in this area right now.
Finally, changes have been made to proposed anti-stalking laws in the Select Committee, with Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith saying that these changes would strengthen the law. How are the ACT Party feeling about these changes?
Well, the law is triggered after two specific acts of stalking within 24 months. Originally, when the bill was proposed, it was 3 in 12 months, but submitters thought that this wasn't strong enough, and the committee, including an ACT MP on the committee, agreed that this change actually better recognises those patterns of stalking behaviour and the time that can pass between incidents. We're also really pleased that the committee has agreed to add new sections to enable the disposal of any intimate visual recordings possessed by a person convicted of a new stalking and harassment offences. So yeah, we support the bill. We've also welcomed progress, we also need to ask what's next in addition to the progress on the stalking bill, because we're really concerned about explicit deep fake images and the digital abuse that that allows, which is why our MP, my colleague Laura McClure, has put up a members bill that would create a specific offence for creating or sharing sexually explicit deep fakes without consent, which would give police and the courts clear authority to act, which they currently don't have. So we see these two things, the stalking bill and Laura McClure's members bill, which allows the criminalisation of explicit deep fakes without consent, as complementary.
Despite being supportive of these changes, the ACT Party have said that police should use their power to provide potential offenders with a written warning that their behaviour could be tantamount to stalking. Would victims be made aware of this process, and if not, would it not jeopardise their safety?
Well, I think it's really important that the police have powers not just to arrest and charge, but to identify when these behaviours are occurring and proactively use written warnings against people who have crossed a line or who are nearing a line. Because what we don't want is people who are vulnerable to be subject to stalking behaviour. And if the police can intervene before that happens or before that individual crosses a line then that's much better for everybody concerned.
Opposition parties, despite also supporting the changes, say more can be done. They propose that those charged with stalking have their firearm license taken away from them and have called for stalking-specific rehabilitation programs. Are these changes the ACT Party would support as well?
Well, one of the good things about our firearms licensing system is it identifies people who are fit and proper persons to hold a firearms license. And if the police are concerned that an individual is no longer a fit and proper person, then of course they have the right to take their firearms and to take their license or suspend their license. So the ACT Party would agree with that.
And with the latter one about calling for stalking-specific rehabilitation programs?
Well, I'll leave that up to the ministers responsible because I don't have any insights into that. But I would have thought that people who are behaving in a repeated way and who are potentially, you know, obsessive or you know, otherwise can't control their emotions that lead to stalking, I'm sure it would be helpful if they were to engage in some cognitive behavioural therapy. Certainly wouldn't be opposed to that. But I don't have any insights into what government's plans are for that.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on ACT local candidates moving to oppose attempts to mitigate emissions at a local level, the government banning two Israeli MPs, and changes made to the proposed anti-stalking laws. We'll be right back.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Manawatia a Matariki. Rhea Hall joins the Auckland Philharmonia this Matariki, performing the groundbreaking album Rules of Engagement, a powerful political record inspired by the 1864 Battle of Pukehinehina. The Trust's Community Foundation presents Matariki with Rhea Hall and the Auckland Philharmonia, live at the Auckland Town Hall, Thursday, June 19. Tickets from aucklandphil.nz.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into Ocean and Ice. On now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
On Wednesday night, you've climbed the mountain of the week and reached the top, but before you roll down the hill, you get a reward. No, it's not the view. This is radio. No, you don't get to meet an all-powerful being. This is an alternative radio station. At the top of the mountain, you get the top 10 songs of the week on 95BFM. Brought to you by the Mountain Guardians, Sam and Jack.
The 95BFM Top 10. The toppest top tracks of the week. 7 to 8 p.m. every Wednesday. Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
Thank you. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
On Friday last week, the consultation process for the proposed new English curriculum for intermediate and high school students ended. The proposed English curriculum will result in senior high school students learning Shakespeare and 19th century texts and spelling and keyboard lessons for younger students. However, concerns have been raised that the proposed curriculum is Eurocentric, does not engage with Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and lacks Māori and Pacific texts. I spoke to Claudia Rosas, a lecturer in critical studies at the University of Auckland, about why elements of Te Ao Māori should be incorporated into the English curriculum and the importance of Māori and Pacific texts being engaged with. What are the proposed changes to the English curriculum?
It's more standardised, so it's a more standardised version of the curriculum compared to what we currently have, which is more of a framework and that details things like achievement outcomes, but doesn't actually detail too much knowledge or content, and a lot of that is largely left up to teachers. So we've got a much more standardised curriculum, that's one thing. It probably has a slightly stronger sense of itself, a more sense of it as being a distinct subject, perhaps, from the others. But from what I can tell, what I would say is that we probably have a curriculum, or at least an English curriculum now, that is in keeping with other changes to curricula that have happened in other Western countries that have what we call, have sort of gone towards the knowledge turn, right? So this notion of a knowledge-rich curriculum, which is, as I say, it's a transnational trend to turn towards knowledge-based curricula rather than a competency-based curricula.
Will the new curriculum engage, well, at least what's been proposed, will it engage with Māori and Pacific authors and Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
Well, that's a good question because, so one of the things that teachers have, the sector has responded quite strongly to, is that even though it is a more standardised curriculum, and I mean some people would say there is a level of prescription that's built in there, so there are particular text requirements and so on. And what people have noticed is that there is a mandate, for example, for all year 12 and 13 students to study Shakespeare and also a 19th century text. However, there is no mandate at all to study Māori authors, Pacific authors, and certainly not what I would call, say, Māori cultural texts or literary traditions, we might say, that are embedded in Te Ao Māori, such as haka, mōtiatia, oriori, whakapauki, and so on. So, you know, very interestingly, for a curriculum that has become more standardised and has got some text requirements, the mandates don't feel like a curriculum that has been written for Aotearoa New Zealand, if that makes sense. So, as I say, it's very much in keeping with broader international terms in terms of, you know, of producing a curriculum that wants to look more Englishy and have some more standardisation. But oddly, and I think this is what the sector is very acutely aware of, oddly, it doesn't feel like an Aotearoa New Zealand curriculum in that regard, which is a shame, because actually if you wanted to have, you know, a knowledge and content rich curriculum that was different from what we currently have, that which, as I say, is more competency based and follows achievement objectives, you could actually have that, you could enact that type of curriculum, but that was reflective of our country and our own cultural and linguistic traditions that we have in Aotearoa New Zealand.
You briefly touched on this, but why is it important to engage with Māori and Pacific authors in English classrooms, especially here in a contemporary Aotearoa?
I mean, that's a really good question, and in fact, I think it's a question that this whole process has raised and made us think about, because I guess it's a question about culture and the place of culture in the curriculum. And English as a subject, and I guess English has always been a contentious subject and always will be. There will always be that tussle, you know, between tradition and new ways of thinking and so on. But English is a subject where you can't really take culture out of it. In some ways, culture is kind of its point, because what we do in English is that we celebrate and we focus on the texts that say something and speak to us, right, as a nation and as a society. And my sense is that with the coalition government and the minister, there has been a desire, you know, a type of course correction, if you like, from what they would see as something that paid too much attention, perhaps, to culture in sort of under the previous government. So, you know, and they've been quite open. I mean, the government, Chris Luxon, David Seymour and so on, have been quite open about not wanting any type of policy that looked race-based or stupidity-based in any way. And you can see that has come out in the curriculum, which is quite a concern because, as I say, in the context of English, you can't really take culture out of it, right? And so, yes, you can have your knowledge, you can have your content, but you can't take culture. And my sense is that we've ended up with the curriculum that we have due to a government that is almost allergic to the concept of anything that looks or feels like it's going to look, you know, be race-based. And so they've sort of gone through and produced a curriculum that, as the sector, I think, is quite rightly noting, has got some slightly conservative elements in it, but also doesn't sort of have a strong sense of Aotearoa New Zealand. There's a little bit of sense in there, but, you know, I think we've ended up with something that is quite diminished in that context because it hasn't sufficiently engaged with who we are. So on the one hand, it is part of an international trend. I think we can look at this curriculum and we can look at things that have happened in Australia, for example, and we can make some connections and see how these patterns are emerging. But at the same time, there's that kind of bespokeness or element to it that is particular to our society at the moment, which is to have a government that is committed to not having anything that looks like it's paying too much attention to culture or race-based policy, if that makes sense.
Are there differences about the literary styles of Māori and Pacific authors that could benefit understanding of literacy overall for students?
Of course. You know, haka, and I was talking to a friend of mine just recently. In fact, I was talking to Glenn Cahoon, who's a poet who's recently published a book, two companion texts of oral traditions. One is European Pākehā traditions and the other is Māori oral traditions. And, you know, we were just talking about a haka, for example, the structure of a haka. And so this is, you know, people are saying, well, everyone should know the structure of a sonnet. Why shouldn't young people in New Zealand understand and know the structure of a haka that is equally filled with allusion, metaphor, and all the other things that are connected to, you know, to English, to figurative language and so on. So the advancement of the things that we think of as being very Englishy, or particularly, say, in the context of figurative language, of oral literary traditions and how we tell stories, particularly stories about who we are and so on, are all right there. So absolutely students in our country could benefit. I mean, for Māori, it's a way of sustaining their culture. It is not unreasonable for Māori to expect their cultural tech and their linguistic traditions to be sustained through our education system. That isn't unreasonable. And for the rest of us who are not Māori, why would we not wish to broaden our horizons in this way? These are traditions that are unique to this country. And here was an opportunity, you know, as I say, again, under the desire for a knowledge or content-rich curriculum, here was an opportunity to explore that a little further. And I think we're at the beginnings of that exploration because such an exploration would need to be respectful and slow and obviously in conversation with Māori experts in such you know, in such traditions. So it's not necessarily that I think this curriculum could have produced, you know, here it is, everybody go away and do these things, but the curriculum could have at least started that conversation and created a space within the curriculum in order to do that. And that space may well be there. And I think teachers may well find that space and cultivate that space. However, it, as I say, it's not mandated. And if, you know, as other things are, and if you don't, it, to mandate something, you give it legitimacy. And so if it's not mandated, then we're saying something about the value, about the worth of such tradition.
You've also touched on this, but why does the country's English curriculum have a responsibility to maintain elements of Te Ao Māori and Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
I think, well, in my view, this is what a national curriculum does. And I guess I have been on the knowledge side, you know, to some degree in all of these debates. So I've not been a supporter of a competency-based curriculum. I think that young people should know things. And, you know, all the other the sorts of competencies that people want, like problem solving, critical thinking and so on, depend on a knowledge base. So you have to have a knowledge base first. But that's one part of curriculum. That's one function of curriculum. It's a very important function. But curriculum also plays a cultural role and a social role in a society. And part of that is that connection to culture. It's saying something to us about who we are and who we wish to be. And I don't think, again, I think that under the coalition government, there's been a desire to present something that looks neutral, that's free of ideology and so on. And that's all very well. But in fact, you know, there's always some ideology at play anyway. And so what that has created then is a sense that this curriculum and, you know, the minister keeps saying this is knowledge rich, informed by the science of learning, which is another topic, but which is all well and good, that's fine. But it reduces curriculum to these functions. And I, in my view, the work of curriculum is always more expansive in society, and it does have a responsibility. I think that's a good word for it. As I say, it's not unreasonable for Māori to expect that their sociocultural knowledge will be sustained somehow through education. And so that is a responsibility on the curriculum, because the work of curriculum is more than just knowledge, you know. And although I say that as someone who is in principle supportive of a knowledge-based curriculum.
And how should culture play a role in our curriculum?
Well, again, so we'll just go back to English, because it will be different for different subjects, and I can only really talk about English. One of the aspects, I mean, English is literature, it's language and literacy, which is slightly simplistic, but we can think about English in that way. And culture is sort of playing out, right? So it's literature. So we have Māori literature. We have Pacific literature, Pacific authors and Māori authors. So it plays out in that context. So again, if you're going to mandate 19th century texts, why are we not mandating Māori authors or a Pacific author? In the context of language, again, there's, you know, there's the figurative work, but also the cultural traditions, these linguistic traditions. And these linguistic traditions give meaning to culture. They give meaning to our lives. A haka gives meaning to something, a karakia at the beginning of something that's taking place in a marae, for example, the waiata that is sung. These things give meaning to our culture. And in the context of English, they are oral traditions, and oracy is part of English. In fact, in the new curriculum, it talks about, you know, reading, writing and oracy. So, you know, oracy is in there, and these oral traditions give meaning to our cultures in the same way that we all sit around and we put candles on a cake and we sing happy birthday to each other. You know, in Te Ao Māori, there are cultural texts and linguistic traditions that give meaning to the things that we do and to who we are, that are unique to this country. So that's, and I guess that's what I'm thinking, is the connection between culture and English.
That was the University of Auckland's Claudia Rosas on the proposed new English curriculum for intermediate and high school students and the need to engage with Te Ao Māori in the process. We'll be right back. Text in 5395 on any of your thoughts on these pieces.
If my heart bends, I'll know. And if I had to stay, you know I would have stayed. So baby, don't hold me back, 'cause if I win, I'll change.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
The government has reduced staffing at the National Geohazard Monitoring Center that amounts to a 25% reduction. Previously, the center has operated 24/7. However, these cuts will result in the need to close periodically based on staff availability. With the increasing frequency of natural disasters both in New Zealand and internationally, this has the scientific community concerned for our readiness for the next natural disaster. I spoke to PSA organizer Claire Nixon about these reductions and what they could mean for the community. The cuts will result in the 24/7 nature of the center changing to have closed times. How much of a strain will that put on those working in the center?
So the cuts that have happened to the NGMC, the National Geohazards Monitoring Center, is for shifts to reduce from 4 people to 3 people. So there's 5 shifts, so 20 people going down to 15. That means that there'll be 3 people who shift. They require 2 staff minimum to have the center open. And so that means that from time to time, it won't be every day or every week even, but from time to time the centre may need to close because of not being able to meet that minimum 2 per shift. You know, if you think, obviously people need to take annual leave, occasionally people will be sick, that kind of thing, and from time to time that could happen. We may also see people being asked to do a lot of overtime as well, and that can certainly place strain on the staff who are in there with more fatigue and things like that. So in terms of the staffing, I guess it's not clear at this point exactly how often the centre may need to close, but it is clear that will occur from time to time. And the main impact that will have in terms of on the public is that the National Geohazards Monitoring Centre has a role in ensuring that advice is received by appropriate authorities as quickly as possible. And it's that speed that's the main thing that their role is getting that advice out as quickly as possible.
Okay, so how has the scientific community responded to these funding and staffing cuts?
It's a great question. So the funding, it's driven by the funding cuts. So the GeoNet had an operation, which the National Geohazards Monitoring Centre is part of GeoNet. GeoNet had funding of about $31 million in the current financial year that's coming to an end on 30th of June. And then that the government reduced that funding to $26 million in the coming year and then down to $24 million in future years. So that's a cut of almost $7 million over a number of years. And that's reflective of cuts we're seeing across the science system. And the government have also cut key research funds 2 years in a row now. So we're seeing, I guess, a degradation of the services provided by GeoNet, and that's a direct result of government decisions, and that also mirrors the funding cuts we've seen in other parts of the system. So the science community are seeing this as another example of the government degrading the funding that we have for science in this country, which means that we cannot, assess risks and we can't do all of the stuff that we've been doing to date, and some of those work programs will have to stop. So it's overall, in terms of the science community, it's another example of the same thing that they've been seeing over the past 2 years.
Given the regularity of seismic activity in certain parts of New Zealand, how serious of a threat does this funding reduction pose?
So GeoNet and GNS itself have both tried to, obviously they've been required to degrade that service. That wasn't a decision that they made. In an ideal world, they would have had the same amount of funding or more to go into GeoNet, but they don't. So they've had to make decisions to degrade their services. They have tried to, I guess, spread that degradation across a number of different services that GeoNet provides. The National Geohazards Monitoring Centre is probably the most kind of visible one with the clear 25% reduction in staffing, but they have had to degrade other services within GeoNet as well in order to achieve that funding. And the government has sort of said, just work more efficiently or whatever, but that's just not realistic. If you're going to reduce funding by that amount, it's going to affect services. So, yeah, that is a concern. Obviously, in an ideal world, they would have had the same or more funding. GeoNet's plan was to hopefully grow and continue to add to their services, and now it's going backwards. So, of course, New Zealand is quite a geologically active country, and so it's top of mind for a lot of people about these things because, many of us have seen a number of big earthquakes over our lifetimes, and we'll see many more. So, yeah, of course, the shutting of the NGMC, there's a chance that will happen on any given shift, and then what's the chance of an earthquake happening at the same time as that? They may not coincide each time, but if that continues for long enough, then obviously that risk of the centre shutting at a time when there's a big earthquake increases the longer that goes on. So yeah, I think it's certainly a concern. It's a concern that the government doesn't value science advice, and it's a concern that goes beyond just GeoNet and GNS as well. It goes across the whole science system.
Are you guys in conversation with the government about this? And if they're unresponsive, is there anything that the community can do to help?
Sure. So PSA has been doing a number of things to raise these issues over the past couple of years. So of course, PSA's, we represent about 3,000 workers in science. So we have been obviously working directly with those workers to raise their issues to appropriate levels. We have also worked with the New Zealand Association of Scientists to help set up the Save Science Coalition, which is a group of 30 different unions and scientific societies who all share an interest in a well-funded and well-functioning science and research system. So a key action that that group is taking is kind of documenting all of these cuts, because science is funded from so many different places, it's hard for the average person to kind of see, you know, how many roles have been cut, how much funding has been cut. So the role of that group is to kind of draw that picture for people to show this is what's been happening. So for people who, you know, the average New Zealander, how can you help? So I would say just talk to people about these issues would be one thing New Zealanders can do to help. There's a website you can go to, or on the Save Science Coalition. If you Google that, you'll find it, and you can find all the information about the, you know, the cuts that have happened, and you know, some stories about the impacts and things like that. And yeah, if people kind of share that information, then that will help get the message out there. But this has been a growing concern over the past 2 years. We saw under the previous government, they invested a fair bit of money into science infrastructure in Wellington in particular, and that was all taken away, and then we've seen further cuts since then under the current government. So it's explicitly a result of decisions of this current government. We've also been trying to meet with the minister and things like that. We have managed to meet with him on one occasion for half an hour, but getting in front of decision makers has been more difficult under this government than it was under the previous. So write to your minister, that's another, write to your local MP, write to the minister, that's another thing that people can do to raise issues if they are concerned about this. Let them know what you think, because if we, you know, if enough of us say something, then maybe they'll hear it. So yeah, those are a few things that people can do.
That was PSA organiser Claire Nixon on the government's staff and funding reductions to the National Geohazard Monitoring Centre. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
The Auckland Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
95BFM presents The Saints, 73-78, making their New Zealand debut at the Power Station, Friday, October 31. Get ready to have your senses pummeled by punk pioneers Ed Cooper, Ivor Hay, Mick Harvey, Mark Arm and Peter Oxley. A once-in-a-lifetime gig. It's The Saints, 73-78, live at the Power Station, Friday, October 31. Tickets available now from plusone.co.nz.
Decalcify your pineal gland, live on broadcast radio. It's a contact lens for your third eye, a pacemaker for your anahata chakra.
Rehabilitate your aura with Aaron on psychic glands. Delicate, psychedelic, transcendent, blissful.
Psychic glands, every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on 95BFM, and available eternally on podcast and RSS at 95BFM.com.
Surf the earth's magnetic core. The Wire.
Whales are some of the most intelligent creatures that we share the Earth with. In light of this, the Princess of Tonga is moving towards officially recognizing personhood for whales in law. I spoke to Dr. Justin Sobian, Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, about the implications of such a move, both legally and for the relevant industries. So my first question is, why is it that we are seeing a push to grant whales legal personhood?
Climate crisis has been getting a lot of attention, especially this decade of this particular century. We had 3 advisory opinions, hearings on climate change in the international fora. It was the International Tribunal of the Sea, ICJ, and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So there's this push really for whales, I think, and it's nothing new to New Zealand, earlier. Even to the wider world. New Zealand, as you know, the first country in the world to give legal personality to the Whanganui River, and then before that, the Tuiwera National Park. India says the Ganges as a legal person, a particular state, and even the Himalayas. So now and even in India, the High Court ruled that all the entire animal kingdom has legal rights or should be treated as a legal entity. So it's not that strange or not that it's something to be bewildered about to see that this push coming, especially from a Pacific Island state, for whales to have legal personality. So I just think it's a general trend that is just keeping on going.
Well, that leads nicely into my next question, which is, why specifically whales? What do they represent in Polynesian culture, and why whales over, say, octopi or dolphins or other intelligent marine animals?
Yeah, I think, as you said at the beginning, whales, dolphins are sentient beings. Scientists are even coming out to say that they are more sensible than we think, even more sensible than Homo sapiens. I think cetaceans are of particular importance, and cetaceans meaning, of course, whales, dolphins. They are particularly important, as we know, to the Maori culture. We saw that the Maori and the king, the past king, and of course, bless his soul, who is not here with us, but we see him having a direct engagement with also his counterparts in the Cook Islands, because whales do play a predominant role in our culture, New Zealand, and then the Pacific Oceans. I have first-hand experience, actually, going to Iwa Island in 2019, just before COVID, and Iwa is in Tonga, one of the Isles of Tonga, and we went on a whale watching trip, and I was pretty much taken away of how the tour guide, the persons in the village, they were very conscious of how, you know, how it wasn't something like we are going to chase the whales or get them disturbed out of their natural habitat. They would sit down in a particular place, do a kind of whale call, tap the boat, and then the whales will come. So it didn't feel like, you know, we were actually, you know, going into their territory. They actually came to us. So I think that whole scenario and that whole backdrop, it is really not surprising to see the Maori culture embracing whales of their Tonga, and even their Pacific brothers and sisters, especially in Polynesia, embracing that culture as well.
If successful, what could this mean for the legal definition of personhood going forward and its application in law?
There must be a distinction between legal personhood and legal personality, and giving somebody human personality. Legal personality means, in the eyes of the law, that these persons are not humans in the anthropocentric view of things, but these entities treated to have legal rights in front of the eyes of the law, merely being because they are sentient beings, and there's no one else who could call to enforce these rights for them. They cannot speak to us. So we should be seeing ourselves as trustees or guardians for these non-humans, just as how a company, for example, has legal personality. We're not saying that the company is a human, but we are just saying that a company can be recognized in the eyes of the law, just as ships, for example, have legal personality. So we are extending this same personality to someone, a non-human, just like a company, just like a ship. These natural animals or entire animal kingdom who live in their natural spaces, that we should be trustees to act on their behalf and speak out for them in case something goes wrong, if we feel that their populations are dwindling. So that's what I think the whole engagement now with human beings acting as trustees for the non-humans, for the animal kingdom. I think that is how the law is going to move forward. I would think by the end of this century, going into the next decade. I think that's a general trend we are looking at.
How much influence does the Princess of Tonga have to affect both Tongan law and international law?
I can't speak much for the domestic laws of Tonga, although I know, of course, it's a common law, so maybe some customary law, just like New Zealand. But definitely on an international stage, the Queen or the Princess of Tonga, I think the royal family of Tonga, of course, they would have a great international standing and they would have moral weight in the international community. I understand they were in the UN Ocean Conference in Nice, at least the delegation at its highest level. So they can actually have a morally persuasive claim or argument at the United Nations or whatever for international fora that we have. Especially coming from the royal family, I would think. Yes.
How would this affect various offshore industries like oil drilling, whaling, and fishing?
Yeah, so that's the biggest problem, humans again. We are the problems and we don't even realize it. We know whales are very significant for significant cuisine or for dining purposes. That's significant in terms of the use of whales. You see, sometimes some countries even claiming that whales can be caught for scientific purposes. And of course, we have tried to say that these purposes need to be drastically reduced. This is the global south state, of course. The whales have also been subject to International Court of Justice hearing many years ago, with which New Zealand was involved. So I think that when we're looking at these cetaceans, I think this is, we, as human beings, we have to realize that we are not the only inhabitants of this earth. We inhabit the earth with many other non-human beings who deserve that right to be respected, who deserve that right for their populations to increase or not decrease, because for the future generations especially. So I think whales earn their right to travel safely or navigate through international waters, for example. That's the point of view that's coming out from Tonga. So I think as human beings, we should be really in sync with this ecological and also ecocentric attitude, because this is what will help us get to the climate crisis, and especially for the future generations, not only human beings, but also the entire animal.
Okay, my final question. What other animals could you see being granted legal personhood in the future? I mentioned dolphins and octopi, but also apes, for example.
Yeah, I understand apes, but besides the Indian case, but I understand apes, there has been a push for them, of course. If I recall, it was somewhere in Africa, maybe in Asia. There has been a push. I don't know where that has been. Whales, of course, that is dolphins, that has been always on our list. In some parts, I even heard, I think I read it last night, that is it Lesotho? They were trying to say lions. Now, the you know what I mean, because they represent the whole Simba and all these things, the the epitome of what you experience Africa to be, so I think lions is a big five, I think, in South Africa. So that's also not also very much surprising there. But who knows? We look forward to other things. I remember having a chat with an Indian delegate many years ago. Peacocks should have legal rights because, of course, they also feature in a lot of scriptures and so on. So I think these are the type of things we are looking at in the near future.
That was Dr. Justin Sobian, Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, on the Tongan Princess pushing for legal personhood for whales.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koto katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the University of Auckland's Claudia Rosas and Justin Sobian, and the Public Service Association's Claire Nixon. Nei ra hoki te mihi kia koto e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.